chaos, not the Maxwell smart evil foe, but the state of disorder and possibly destruction, is often, inaccurately, called anarchy. Anarchy is often misrepresented, even by the Sex Pistols. It's a scary word, and it seems to create an instant response in those who hear it. Does it mean disorder and destruction, or does it mean something else? Today's show is the second hour of my appearance on the Rebel Madman radio show, and we discuss anarchy, what it is, and what it isn't. The Eating Liberty Podcast, episode 248, Food and Freedom Once a Week for Life. Hello, folks. Dan Reed here. Welcome back to the podcast. This is, as stated, hour two of Mike Gaddy's interview of me on his Rebel Madman radio show. As you will recall, last week was the first hour where we discussed my political move from Republican to Libertarian. This hour, Mike asks me about moving from Libertarian to Anarchist. It's a very scary word, which I will address.
So, Dan, help us out here. Tell us about your transition from L to A.
Well, it's almost as uninspired as the R to L, because it wasn't, it was a slow progress. And, you know, one of the things that is the case, I'm certain of it, about anarchy is the word scares the tuna salad out of everybody who doesn't know what it means. And if it was pink puffy sheep, it would say, "Wow, that sounds great. I want that. That's, I want to hug it. I want to be part of that." It's a scary sounding word. Nobody knows Greek, so they don't know what the root of it is. It just sounds terrible. And if you limit yourself to mainstream media movies. Now, I have kids, so we watch a lot of Disney movies. Yes, I know, Disney movies, but some of them entertaining. And there was one called Big Hero 6. One character says, "You can't break the rule. You can't do that. It's going to be anarchy." That's not what he meant. What he meant was chaos. Anarchy is used almost always to mean chaos, and even the founders did the same thing. So anarchy really just means we want rulers. No, backwards. We want rules. We just don't want rulers. And I got in real slow. There was a podcast called Actual Anarchy. Now, what it was, interestingly, was a movie review podcast. But what they would do is review films that entertained them from an anarchy standpoint. And I was a guest on there a couple times. We did Ratatouille, you know, of course, culinary. And we also did Mrs. Doubtfire. I said, "Well, what could be anarchist about Mrs. Doubtfire?" But it was a fun movie to do, a fun movie to also review. And the aspect of the show was finding out where anarchy could exist, where already what exists is government overlords. I think it's a deliberate, very conscious, very thoughtful introspection to realize that most of what I think I need from a quote-unquote government, I probably can be provided by people with the skills to know how to do those things. Oh, well, I'm not even going to get into the arguments. There are plenty of arguments, and not all of the arguments have easy answers. But I think when you the transition was slow, but it sort of just kept culminating in finding out more about the overlords doing things that I don't approve of, the overlords doing things in past decades that no sane, rational people would have approved of, yet they're done anyway. It's as much a response in of favoring anarchism, rules, not rulers, as it is rejecting the form of government we have now. And so I think it for me, it was kind of both of those things at the same time. And this, as I learned more about, we talked a few in the last hour about things like MK Ultra and Operation Mockingbird and Paperclip, and there's dozens of them. I can't remember them all, but all of those things done without the consent of anybody except some guy driving a desk. Well, that's a good idea, Frank. Go ahead and do that. And then I read a book about the atrocities. Many atrocities, the horrors, pretty much the almost complete extermination of 600 tribes of Indians. And who did that? Well, that was the U.S. government who did that. Why'd they do that? Because, well, the horrifying answer is because they could, because manifest destiny, because we have bigger guns than you. So it's a slow process. I don't think, for me, it didn't happen quickly, and I was reluctant because I know how it sounds. I know people, people don't have good reactions to that. So I was slow to own that title.
Well, I think that's appropriate because we've been set up. You know, the Federalist told the people in 1785 through 1787 that if we do not have a strong government with energy, we will have anarchy. Well, then, of course, you know, everyone goes, oh, well, and the analogy is made that anarchy is equal to violence, which is absolutely incorrect. Government is violence. Anarchy is just the opposite. And then, of course, in the 1960s, we got hit with this wonderful publication called the Anarchist Cookbook, where they actually did a publication, which I believe was actually endorsed and written by the CIA. But a publication was put out there called the Anarchist Cookbook that was teaching people how to blow up stuff, how to do this, how to, you know, be anti-government and all these other things. And that was a mind control exercise, just like the Federalists telling people without a super strong government with energy, you're going to have anarchy. So it's
I actually bought that book.
Did you?
My friend and I, we went in because we were in high school. We went down to the bookstore. They ordered it and we went in halvesies on it. And it was exactly that. Lots and lots and lots of ways to create different kinds of incendiary and explosive devices, hand-to-hand combat, how to, well, it's very hard to teach in writing, but how to try to kill your opponent with your bare hand and on the nose, and I don't know what the move is, but you thrust the nose bone into the brain, and yeah, it was nothing. So, you know, we figured that must be, that reinforces the idea that anarchy is chaos. And so because it's in a book, that must be true. It's the 1970s version of it's in the internet, it must be true. And we would never have considered that it was the CIA putting that out. It would have been the last thing from our minds. In fact, we thought it wasn't. How, look at us, man, we're rebels. Look at us. We're doing this thing. We never built the first damn thing. We didn't get any fights. Didn't hurt anybody. Didn't kill anybody. So I guess from that respect, we weren't particularly good readers of the book.
But the impression is that's left in the subconscious is that the anarchist cookbook with all of the various attendees to that, mental attendees, is the fact that an anarchist is a bomber.
Right.
You know, there are people who are going to kill innocent people, when in essence, the opposite is true. It's the government who kills innocent people over and over and over again. And, you know, of course, the pandemic is one. Oklahoma City is one. 9/11 is another one. These wars started on lies is another one. It's the government who randomly kills people, innocent people. Anarchy means without governors, without someone telling you what to do. It does not in any way, shape, form, or fashion have anything whatsoever to do with violence. But it's the perversion of words, which is the very, very object of what we referred to as government intelligence, to pervert words to their usage. So, at what point in time, Dan, did you say to yourself, "Wow, I'm an anarchist"?
Probably within the last month. Just
oh, really? That recently?
Well, I think actually owning the title, I think, yeah, I think, and it's mostly kept between me, myself, and I. There's a lot of people who would balk to the point of not hearing an explanation, and I think one of the important things to do with friendships is recognize what their limitations are, and don't push them past those limitations until they appear to be ready for that. It was a struggle enough to get people to understand the concept of libertarian. I know I've lost both podcast interview hopefuls as guests and real life and people friends over that title of libertarian. It's just I don't know why the guests said no. I have some ideas, but that's not important. I have one fellow who was a friend of my friend, and we were chums, just refuses to be even at the same table with me. Because he loves his government so much that anyone who says otherwise, he wants no part of that. So going the next step is I have to tread carefully.
No, well, I certainly understand that, because I have lost a ton of, I'm not going to call them friends, because if they were friends, they would have taken the time to understand. As you mentioned, once you bring up a certain word, immediately you're rejected, which is a full illustration of their ignorance. And well, that, go ahead, Dan, go ahead.
You know, I think that there's probably a purist who would say, consequences be damned, go forward with that. Well, and part of me, I recognize the value of that. And when I was cooking and as a career, I focused on classical French cooking mostly, but everything from scratch as much as feasible. Ketchup and mayonnaise wasn't made from scratch, because I could not be better than the consistency of Heinz and Hellmann's. It was dependable. I knew what I would get every single time I opened the can, and it wasn't cost effective to try to reproduce that. I was better off putting my efforts and my skills into things that I couldn't buy better than I could make, like puff pastry and bread and all those other things. So And that was tough, and I lost cooks over that because they didn't want to work that hard. Well, and that's fine. We'll find other cooks who want to work that hard. The friends that I have who like me as I am with the labels that I have on me now, I like these people. And politics isn't really a part of it. They know where I stand, But that's never an issue. We don't ever discuss these things. They come up rarely. We have a good time. We go to each other's homes. We watch TV rarely. We go and we have dinners and we drink wine and we chat about gardens and the kids, and we have a really nice evening. And the value to me of that time spent well with people who like me as I am and might like me on the next step, but it's like climbing down a cliff. You can jump and you'll get down, but it's the last thing you're going to do. Or you can very, very carefully find your way step by step, handhold by handhold, and navigate your way down. And that's what I need to do, what I want to do with these people, is slowly introduce these other ideas. Now, I happen to know that these guys are, you know, he told me, he's, you'll never meet a bigger Marxist than me. Well, okay. But that hasn't interfered with having really good meals, really good laughs, a lot of fabulous evenings, good memories, going mushroom hunting. I have a good time. The politics of him and the politics of me don't get in the way of being civil and enjoying his company. And I think the value of having a good, sound human relationship exceeds the value of pissing him off just for the sake of doing it.
Well, that's valid. That's a valid comment. But if today you were to be approached, now, I'm not going to, I certainly don't want to pat myself on the back, but over the course of our relationship, how many times have you come to me with questions, Dan?
I don't think I could count. Many. Numerous.
Well, now let's put you in that position. Let's say that there are people who are just beginning to wake up and they find out that Dan Reed has made this transition, that he went from a R to an L to an A. How do you feel like Dan Reed could help those people today?
Without having a specific question to answer, I think the answer for anyone begins with an earnest self-examination. And that's, it's not a risky thing to do in the terms of you don't really risk physical harm, but a really robust self-examination runs the very real risk of finding out you don't necessarily like what you see in the mirror. And when that happens, you either do something about it or you do nothing about it. And that's a choice you have to make. I decided to do something about it. And that was to... It's hard. I think it's a difficult concept to say that turning your political thinkings from one to another is in any way a self-improvement. But I think the big key in that transition is that I no longer look to an outside force, government's an outside force, as a solution to a problem. I don't know that there is, well, with possible exception of actual military defense of the shores, that might be a legitimate role of government. I don't think there's anything in anyone's specific daily life that the government can do as a benefit. I think that the problems that we face, the real problems we face, not the big ones that we couldn't impact anyway, the things in your daily life that can make day better or worse are managed by the self, and being able to, and thinking about how to do that on your own, affect positive change, is the path that I think ends up leading toward an anarchist mindset, where I'm going to follow rules, but I'm not going to have rulers. And I think that's the without specifics, a good way to begin getting into this.
Okay, well, it's I'm going to whoop a question on you. Are you ready for it?
One more. Okay, let's have it.
Okay. What does government do in society that private enterprise wouldn't do better and cheaper?
Oh, I thought this was a hard question. Nothing.
Well, you mentioned defense of the country. Do you think that that would be better done from a centralized position or done by states?
But that's actually a spectacularly good question, and I think now I sort of anticipated a question like this, and I think it's a tough question to answer. It shouldn't be, but maybe it is, and maybe it shouldn't be hard. I don't know. I think probably it should be a state thing. I don't know. I really don't. There are aspects of the strength of force of the current military regime. It's pretty powerful. One of the key complaints, perhaps the key complaint about the military as it is now, is that it is not confined to domestic defense. It seems preoccupied with international offense, and that's a problem. In most places of the world, the U.S. military is the terrorist, and that's... I don't want my tax dollars going for that. I don't have any say in that. They do it anyway. From a defense standpoint, I don't know how the application would work, but I think probably it should be a state thing. I don't think Nebraska has particularly very much to worry about compared to Maine or New York or South Carolina or Oregon or Washington or California or New Mexico. Well, or Texas. New Mexico's landlocked. The coastal countries, states, yes, Mr. Jefferson, countries, they probably have a more legitimate reason for defense, military-style defense, than, say, Montana, because, you know, those rusty Canadians are going to come marching in any time.
Well,
I'm making a joke, but I think the state is the answer, right? I don't know the application.
Well, here's a question. You know, years ago, they found out that the Defense Department was paying $500 for a hammer and $700 for a toilet seat. In the private enterprise world, or if we go back to the Articles of Confederation, where each state had their own militia, and it was up to the state whether they committed their state militia to these campaigns or not, how do you think that would affect today when we enter into these unconstitutional wars? What would happen if each individual state could tell the federal government, no, you're not taking our military to do that?
Well, I'm going to go back.
Go ahead, please.
I'm going to modify my answer to the previous question by saying there is no we here, if the U.S. military was not in and did not have its nose in the business of all the other countries where it currently has its nose in other people's business, I would surmise, perhaps ignorantly, I'll accept that the risk of invasion, the risk of international offense would be greatly reduced, perhaps never to zero, but I think much less of a risk than it is now. And that's that Ron Paul thing. It's a blowback thing. They have a long vision. They're patiently waiting out. If we weren't making people mad around the world for the last 100 years, maybe we would have less to worry about on our own shores. So in that case, I think the states would be fine as a defense unit, and they probably, you know, if Grumman and, you know, McDonnell Douglas and all those other companies can figure out how to build these things, then other people can figure out how to build these things. So there are people in every state. There's very smart people who know this stuff. So they can probably manage that in those states. So the question you asked about unconstitutional wars, well, that's kind of the same thing. And that goes back to foreign policy is domestic policy. If we just stopped being the policeman, again with the we, it's very hard to talk about that without saying we. If we just stopped being the policeman of the world, trying to tell everybody what they should be doing and minding their own business instead of minding our own business, it's entirely possible that they would be a lot better off in the world all the way around. And you know what? People are going to war. That's simply what's going to happen. And back to those 600 Indian tribes, they warred long before we got here. And people war still for all kinds of reasons. And usually, I don't think you're going to stop war. Wouldn't that be nice to be able to stop war? That would be sweet. I don't know if that's possible. But being an instigator does not stop war.
Well, Dan, how would anyone logically explain the fact that we have military installations in 130 plus different countries, but yet our borders are unprotected militarily?
There is no logic to that. It can't be reasoned away.
But Americans accept that. Why?
Oh, because the government told them so.
Okay, so
that's back to what we were talking about earlier. There, and we even made a joke this morning on Messenger or something, where if there was a level of intelligence to make rational decisions, I don't think that's not what we said, but the level of intelligent folks in positions to make sound choices seems to be woefully in danger. The level of intelligence part.
Well,
maybe book smart.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to step on you there, buddy. Go ahead.
No, I was just quipping that they might be book smart, but that doesn't translate into actual smart.
Well, you know, back in 2016, during the election cycle, I had a lot of friends who were telling me, oh, we've got to support Trump because he's going to build a wall. And I said, well, I've lived in southern Arizona, and I will tell you the wall that is up in Nogales is useless. It does little to nothing to stop people coming across. I said, if Trump was valid, or any other politician, not just Trump, but it was Trump at the time, if any other politician was actually sincere about protecting our borders, he would have not said, I'm going to build a wall, which is going to cost you more money. He would have said, I'm pulling our troops out of these countries and I'm putting them on our borders. That would have been a realistic response. Someone who tells you they're going to build a wall is ridiculous.
Well, that would be good use of the federal government arm, forces that I just said should defend the border. Now, whether or not we agree that there needs to be a federal standing army, and we can go back to the founders, and then they made some arguments about the dangers of having a standing army and what's going to happen if you do that.
Right.
They weren't always wrong, but when they were wrong, they were colossally wrong, but they were sometimes right. Having a standing army will lead to the things we have, so don't have that. But since we do have it, and there seems to be a fair number of bodies to defend the border, that seems a reasonable approach to using the resources we currently have.
Well, in 2005, Dan, when we were heavily involved in the Minuteman Project, the President of the United States, George W. Bush, called us vigilantes. And our program was what we said was, we're just doing what the government refuses to do, and that's protect our own borders. Well, here comes the music. We'll be back on the other side.
Pick up your copy of Cooking for Comfort from the blog page or from Amazon and make fabulous meals in one pot for your family. They will love you for the deliciousness, and you will love it because it's easy. Cooking for Comfort on Amazon or the blog page.
Again, of course, I've got my good buddy Dan Reed here, and we have a caller. We've got James in Vancouver. James, talked to you once today. Buddy, how you doing?
Yes. Well, you're talking about anarchy today, am I right?
Yes, and, sir, we are.
Are you familiar with the writings of Kenneth N. Waltz? His book is Theory of International Politics.
Not especially, no.
Okay, well, in that book, Waltz defines anarchy in a way that is applicable to the relation of states around the world, and they're in a state of anarchy. That is to say, there's no outside force that can compel them to do what they want to do when they want to do it. And anarchy is used in the theory, actually Waltz's theory of neorealism, in order to predict what will happen in international relations when there are conflicts, you see. And I just wondered if you're familiar with that.
Well, I'm familiar with the concept, James, and I think anyone, you know, with two brain cells to rub together knows that if someone can coerce you by force to do something you don't want to do, you're not free.
Right, exactly. Of course, the anarchy between states is one thing. The anarchy on the individual level still exists, though, because if I decide to drop out from a situation, say, day-to-day life, like, for example, I refuse to take the COVID shots, okay? That's anarchy. I'm practicing that. And, again, I stay alive. Those who aren't anarchists at that point and go along with the issue, well, then they pay the price. Back to you.
I agree. I totally agree, James, and I certainly appreciate your input. And I agree with that, and I believe that if anarchy is to prevail, true anarchy is to prevail, it must be done on an individual basis.
Right. And I wanted to say one more thing, as I did some digging around there, and it was Thomas H. Moorer, who was the admiral of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, that probably sent that boat out. And there was probably an intense catfight between him and Johnson over this whole issue. And the pushback, and it would have been a catfight like hell wouldn't know. You see what I mean? I knew it had to be.
Right.
In fact, they interviewed Moorer in 1983 and later at the presentation of the Congressional Medal of Honor. And if I have more time, I'd like to read those quotes on air. But in the sake of time, I'll just let you guys go.
We'll get you on at some point to read those. And, that would have been, I wish you would have had them this morning or yesterday. Would have been a perfect time for that. And I appreciate it, but I don't want to take time away from my guests today.
Right. Well, let's do it again sometime. And I just want to, I'll let you guys go. Thanks. Bye
now. All right. Thanks, James. Appreciate it, buddy. And now let's jump to my dog, Rex, in Florida. I think I know you, buddy.
Hey, gentlemen, thanks for letting me in. I got a question for Dan. A court case, I think it's 82 or 87, titled Bowers versus DeVito, where the court ruled that the Constitution is a charter of negative liberties. It tells the state to let the people alone. It does not require the state or the federal government to provide services, even so elementary a service as maintaining law and order. Now, if that isn't the description of anarchy that the government violates on a daily basis, and they do this because they got rid of the militia, where volunteers would show up to defend the rights of their neighbors, and they've outlawed that. Man can't do it himself anymore, it seems. But do you have a thought on that, or have you even come across that case?
You want to direct that? Dan, you answering, sir?
Well, I'll answer a little bit. I don't know anything the case, but I do. But the concept of rights is an interesting thing. So what in the libertarian thinking, there's two. It's very complicated. But the negative rights and positive rights, the things you can't do, which is what they would say is the Bill of Rights, and that's an entirely different show. The negative rights is what most libertarians are supporting, the things that the government can't do. The positive rights is what I'm going to get this part maybe a little bit wrong, but that is all the things we can do to you. And so I don't know the case. It sounds like your assessment is, if they have said these are things that they can't do and then they go and do them anyway, it's a quip to say it, but welcome to Government 101.
Well, it says they have no duty to maintain law and order, yet they're around the world maintaining some kind of law and some kind of order under a trespass, which means that the people have the right to maintain the law and order, which they do that by truth and honor and justice, it seems. But the government has no duty to protect, yet they claim everything they do is to protect, and it's just, they describe anarchy and then they violate every bit of it, it seems.
Well, it sounds also a little bit like and I forgot the name of the cases, but there have been a couple of Supreme Court cases, and this came up in the Texas school shooting, Uvalde, that police have no obligation to protect you. Maybe people at large, or society as a whole, but you, sir, aren't society as a whole, so you're excluded from actual protection. So it turns out that everybody individually is excluded from being protected. So it seems to be one of these things, and I'm going to reduce it down to something that I can at least speak about, where they say one thing, but they do a completely different thing. And no one is held to account. There's no accountability for any of that stuff. They just keep making stuff up and doing it and undoing it. And to what end?
Well, Dan, I would like to add with that, with what you've said, let's go back to 2005 in Castle Rock v. Gonzalez, in which the Supreme Court, in a 7-2 decision, stated exactly what you just stated, and that was the police have no obligation whatsoever to protect you. And they have a blanket to protect the community, but as an individual, there is no obligation for the government to protect an individual. And a gentleman wrote a very poignant book many years ago called Dial 911 and Die. And he went through all 50 states and produced the evidence to where the police had failed to protect the people that they claim, you know, they used to have that thing on the car, to protect and serve. Bullcrap. They're there to collect revenue. They are not there to protect you, and the government's not there to protect you. And I really appreciate it, Rex, that you brought up that fact. But one of the things that I tell people, you know, when people start quoting, and not directed at you, Rex, but when people start telling me, well, the Supreme Court said this, the Supreme Court said that, I said, well, are you aware that the Supreme Court has reversed itself 328 times during its existence?
Correct.
Reversed its own decisions. So how am I to depend on anything the Supreme Court said? Because they may reverse it tomorrow.
Well, this was a federal court, but still... It describes
same
anarchy,
thing.
perfectly, and then they always act contrary to keeping their hands to themselves. Thank you, gentlemen.
Absolutely. Thank you. Appreciate the call, Rex. Thank you so very, very, very much. And now we have Andy down in Texas. Andy, how are you, sir?
Well, hey, thanks, gentlemen, for taking my call. Interesting conversation. First and foremost, on anarchy, have either of you guys ever heard of Jeff Berwick? He has a BitChute channel. He used to be on YouTube for a while. It's called Dollar Vigilante.
I'm not familiar with his name, but I don't know him.
Well, he's one of the biggest anarchists. He puts on a show, not a show, but an event in the Secret Garden in Acapulco every year in February, somewhere in that neighborhood. He puts on a big anarchy thing where people just come there and they get to talk. You know, there's people like Max Egan, there's people like Del Bigtree, there's people like Dan Dix, and all these people go to this show and stuff, and it's just a fascinating thing. But that's not what I called about. In all honesty, I really wanted to talk this morning when you were on another show, my friend. I wanted to ask you about, wasn't there like 8 or 9 presidents prior to George Washington? You know, like John Hanson was the first one, right? And he put the first script out there to pay the soldiers, and he also established the first post office. Am I correct?
Now, that is correct, but they were presidents of the Congress assembled. They were not presidents of the United States.
Yeah, like interim. Yeah, they were interim, so to speak.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And were you aware that the last president of the Congress actually offered to a prince... for him to come to America and to be king.
Oh, my. They offered the same thing to George Washington, right?
They wanted him to be king. Exactly. And Washington acted as if he was king, except that Washington was not. You know, he may have had the name of president, but the letters, especially the letters between Jefferson and Washington, would indicate beyond a shadow of a doubt that Alexander Hamilton was running the government. George Washington was a figurehead.
So I read a book about, not Thomas Paine, but, Well, okay, so I'm off the thought. All right, gentlemen, you guys have a good night.
All right. Thanks, Andy. Appreciate it. Dan, any response, sir?
No, the first guy he mentioned, the Dollar Vigilante, easy for me to say. I know I recognize that handle, but I haven't followed him. I don't know the person.
Oh, okay. And I know, you know, there's lots of people out there you know, Larkin Rose has been into that Acapulco event. I have a lot of respect for Larkin Rose, and I agree with a lot of his stances, especially, you know, that we don't need government. One point I wanted to get to, Dan, was when we talked about the military, let's not forget on September the 10th of 2001, the good old Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, went on national television and said there is $2.3 trillion missing from the Defense Department and we can't find it. Now, oops. That $2.3 trillion has never been accounted for, and ironically, the next day, allegedly, a plane crashes into the financial part of the Pentagon.
Imagine the odds.
Yeah, imagine the odds of that actually happening. Of course, it was a cruise missile. It wasn't an airplane. But, you know, Americans will believe anything if the government says it.
Which goes back to something we talked about both in this hour and the last hour.
Yes, exactly. It has become a religion. It is a religion. And what really bothers me is when the Christian community treats the government with more respect than it does their own Christian faith. And we saw that in spades during the COVID hoax. We saw it over and over again. Preachers would not open their churches because the government told them they couldn't. So who was their God?
Well, it's, you know, this has been, I don't know, and I'm not sure if it could be proved that this has been planned for some time, but it has turned out to be a very handy thing, because when you pray to your God of the state, quite often your prayer is answered with some urgency, whereas praying to God, you may or may not get your prayer answered. If it comes answered, it may not be in the form in which you expected. So, you know, there's a convenience of getting exactly what you want from the nanny state, whereas from God, well, you might be on your own. You're not really on your own, but you know, we want easy. We want microwave fast, and the state gives it.
Instant gratification, right?
Yes.
Oh, it kind of reminded me, my grandfather warned me years ago. He said, boy, when you pray, never ask for patience.
It's funny.
He said, never ask for patience because you're not going to like what happens. And
he's right.
But then he told me with a little bit of a smirk on his face, he said, you know, I once prayed to God for patience, and I said, God, I want patience, and I want it right now. So I think that is probably in attuned with so many of the so-called Christian conservatives we have in America today who have absolutely forgotten the first commandment, because they will tell you straight up. And it's like my friend Cal Robbins said, you know, there is a, he even sent it to me. I didn't want anything to do with it, but there's actually, you know, a set of Christians on the internet that claim that the Constitution is their Bible.
Well, that's just funny.
Yeah, it's kind of a sickening funny, but, yes, it is true. And, it's just amazing, Dan, but before we run out of time here, I want you to tell the people, and I certainly appreciate you taking time out of your schedule to come be on my program, but tell the people a little bit about how they can learn about Dan Reed and his culinary skills.
Well, everything is on the culinarylibertarian.com blog. So that's the website, the easiest way to get all the podcasts. And the podcasts range in subject from kitchen cutlery. There's an episode with a guy who makes exquisite chef knives. There's a lot of food stuff there. There's recipes on the blog. You are on there a couple times. There's politics. There's food politics. There's big ag corn. And that is culinarylibertarian.com/podcasts, the plural part, the S at the end. And there's some 247 episodes there. And then you can just sort of mill around the rest of the website and poke around. I've got more than a few recipes up there, bread and a lot of baking. If you like baking, there's a lot of baking recipes, some cooking, and a little bit of gluten-free, which is something that I make more than I post, but I'm getting into publishing some gluten-free recipes because of a particular need in my household.
Well, I tell you what, Dan, I haven't spent a lot of time at your blog, but I have noticed a lot of the dishes that you have on Facebook that you're talking about, and I tell you what, buddy, they sure look delicious to me, and if I had any culinary skills, I'm not much at preparing food. I'm just really good at eating it.
Yeah, you said that before. Your wife does all the cooking, especially for the peach cobbler.
Yeah, that's for sure. That is absolutely for sure. But, Dan, I just can't thank you enough again, buddy, for coming on, because it's not easy for most people to actually talk about this transition. And when I thought about doing this, I could think of no one that I thought who would do it better.
Well, so, I appreciate that.
And, you know, and it is. And one of the great things for me is that I have been fortunate enough to be in a position to sit and watch you make this transition over the past, what have we been connected now for?
A year, maybe better than a year, maybe 14, 15 months.
Right, somewhere in that time frame, and I have just been very, very impressed with your transition.
Well, and how you that.
And the fact is that you are always asking questions, and I love that, because that is the sign. If a person is going to tell you something or give you their opinion, that's one thing. But when people are asking questions, and you know, I can't even remember the times you have said, "Where can I find this? Where can I find that?" You are educating yourself, and that is crucial. Is the fact
that it's always in someplace in your library that I can't get to?
Well, you know, my library is rather expansive, and it takes me some time, you know, sometimes to find exactly what you're looking for. So,
can I plug a book that isn't mine?
Please do.
So, for the listeners who are wanting more, and I talked about reading a lot. So, whether you like him or not isn't important. Michael Malice is the editor, collector of a series of essays about anarchism. He's a Russian emigrated anarchist himself, has a little bit of intros, but the chapters are by other people. It also includes Murray Rothbard's Anatomy of a State. The book is called The Anarchist Handbook, not to be confused with The Anarchist Cookbook. It's available on Amazon in Kindle or paperback, and I found it very enlightening because it addresses a lot of the kinds of questions that would be standard. But what about? And the authors have good answers. And it isn't. So the first thing to know, there isn't utopia. Nobody has that. You certainly don't have it now. But it's worth investigating and reading and finding your own place. Where do you stand in this idea? And there's some really good support from people in the past who can give you a firm foundation on your new intellectual stand.
Oh, thanks for that recommendation, and I concur with that. I think that is a very interesting reading for the folks who find themselves somewhere, you know, maybe just a little bit put off with the libertarian aspect, and they're looking for another answer, and I think that is a very, very good answer. So, folks, the one thing I would ask you folks to do is to please, if you get the opportunity, go to michaelgaddy.substack.com. I'm putting up a lot of source documentation, a lot of older articles, some of them as old as 30 years. One of them I'll be putting up is one that I'm very proud of, has been up for 20 years at UnitedNativeAmerica.com. I will be posting that in the very near future. And here's the music. Folks, thank you so much for the time. Dan, thank you, sir.
My pleasure.
And God bless everyone. Have a wonderful rest of the weekend.
All right, folks, that's going to do it. Mike writes a Substack where he posts articles, both current and previously published, about real history, supported by original source documents. And he's got, I don't know, 80,000, it's unbelievable, 80,000 documents you've probably never seen and are not on the internet. So he's got he's got deep resources. He also posts his Whistlin' Dixie podcast episode, and By the time you hear this, he might have even included something else. I'll add a link to that Substack on today's show notes page, culinarylibertarian.com/248. I will also add a link to the Michael Malice book, The Anarchist's Handbook. The book is a collection of essays that really do push the reader to understand what anarchy is and how it can work. And they are not essays by Malice. These are, I have the Kindle version, so I can't look at the table of contents. I mentioned Murray Rothbard. There's, 16 or so spectacular articles there, essays. Really, it's quite impressive. Very well done. There is no chef's table for this episode, but the archive remains on the Patreon. Find the support link on the show notes page. Have a good week, and I'll see you soon. Music for the Culinary Libertarian podcast is provided by Matthew Bankert at mattbankert.com.